Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The race for the 12th congressional district remains too close to call. Roughly 1,500 votes separate Republican Troy Balderson from Democrat Danny O'Connor. About 8,000 provisional and absentee ballots will be counted by August 24th. We'll talk about all that and more in our weekly reporter roundtable today. Joining us, Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome back, Jim.
Good morning.
And also Associated Press correspondent Julie Carr-Smythe. Welcome back.
Good morning, Ann.
It's a close race. But it's not just close, it's super close, particularly for a district that was drawn to favor Republicans, right?
Right. It's a big deal that Danny O'Connor got this close. It's probably a long shot that these additional votes would change.
Yeah.
Right. However, Donald Trump won the district by 11 points. So to get within this margin. And of course, previously, Pat Tidbury held the district and always had a resounding victory.
And before
that,
John Kasich. Right.
Right. And all these are Republicans, obviously. Mm-hmm. So the Associated Press declined to call the race because of the fact that there are these groups of provisional ballots and also some. There's a grand total of 8,500 when you also add in the absentees, but that doesn't mean all 8,500 of those are going to come in. Some of the provisionals won't be valid.
Won't hold up, right.
And a lot of the absentee ones will not, you know, people lost them or they didn't get them in the mail in time or whatever the case may be. So it's yet to be seen, but it's definitely energized Democrats, I would say, because of the fact that O'Connor got so close in a district that really shouldn't have been competitive.
Mm-hmm. The odds that these votes change their trajectory, Jim Siegel, we were saying statistically it's not unlikely, but why is that? It's a lot of votes.
Well, it's a lot of raw votes. However, again, as Julie said,
well, with the ones, the provisionals that don't make it.
Right. As Julie said, these are not all going to be counted and not because of some nefarious reason. They're just not legit votes or they're absentee ballots that were never returned. You always have some folks who maybe they got their ballot late. Maybe they got their ballot and threw it away and accidentally or forgot that they had gotten their ballot in the mail and they show up at the polls. Now, when they do that, they have to cast a provisional ballot because at the polls, they have it registered that you got a mailed ballot. Now, you can still cast a provisional ballot. However, right now, it's kind of counted two times. It's counted once in the 8,400 number. It's counted once as a ballot that wasn't returned. And it's also you're also now counted as a provisional ballot, which they have. Everyone has 10 days to sort of rectify their provisional ballots to make sure that they, in fact, are a legitimate voter living in the 12th district. And we are told that there are some folks in Franklin County and probably some others that cast provisional ballots and didn't actually live in the 12th. And there's a number of these absentee ballots that will not be counted just because they won't be returned or won't be returned in time. So 84 isn't really 8,400 isn't the real number.
Right.
I don't know what the real number is, but it's going to be lower than that. Probably I would be surprised if we got over 6,000.
Right. And the other thing about the trajectory is that the outstanding votes tend to trend the way the race did, which went to Balderson in the unofficial total. So they won't be able to count these until they begin the canvass.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We're talking about that 12th congressional district race. It is still undecided, technically. The Associated Press has not called it. About 1,500 votes separate leader and a Republican, Troy Balderson, from Democrat Danny O'Connor. It's supposed to be a safe Republican district. So coming within 1,500 votes is close, very, very close. It doesn't feel that way to the naked eye, but it surely is. By August 24th, the votes will have been counted. 600 ballots were lost and then found. Again, not nefarious. What do we know about that?
I think that they just did not. I mean, they do a routine sort of audit the next morning to make sure that all the precincts have turned in their, I don't know if they come in the form of ballot boxes or ballot containers, whatever. Mm-hmm. And there were some precincts missing. They were from Worthington. They came in and favored Danny O'Connor by 180 votes, or he got an extra 180 closer. So, you know, back to the reason that the AP wouldn't call it is that we don't call races that go to an automatic recount. Mm-hmm. So as of when I left on election night prior to the additional 180, Danny O'Connor was at 0.866% difference from Balderson. And so the idea that these outstanding votes might bring it within the 0.5% that is needed for a recount is still possible.
Help me catch up. I mean, I was out of town, but the turnout was good.
It was pretty good, 37%.
For an August 7th special election.
Yeah, it was definitely higher than I think a lot of people thought it would be. I think getting over 30 was, I think, pretty surprising.
Yeah.
But look, this got a singular focus as the only congressional race in the country. Once the polls started to close, you started to see the outside groups start coming in and pouring money into this race. Then you had Mike Pence show up and then Donald Trump show up. And all of a sudden, this really became a thing, whereas it was a bit sleepy for the first maybe 6 to 8 weeks of this this race. It certainly picked up in the end, which was definitely reflected in the vote. Obviously, this is not as high of a turnout as you'll see in a general or even an off-year election in November.
Uh-huh.
But for an August election, I mean, it was good. And especially in Franklin County, Franklin County held a higher percentage of the vote in this total than it usually does in this district. I think it was up over, I can't remember the exact percentage, but it was definitely into the mid-30s, I think, in terms of percentage of the total vote. And that's higher than it normally comes in.
The Troy Balderson, the Republican, was speaking recently, and he did say that the Franklin County could pose some problems. Let's listen to this cut.
My opponent is from Franklin County, and Franklin County has been challenging. We don't want somebody from Franklin County representing us.
That has kind of gotten a little bit of attention because, of course, Pat Tiberi and John Kasich, his predecessors, were both Republicans from Franklin County, and they always seem to win.
Right. And there's so much in that statement. I mean, Franklin County is part of the district.
Right.
And so certainly anyone who's from Franklin County, who's within the district and is a legitimate candidate, is equally able to represent the district according to the way our elections work in this country. And it was signaling, I think, to his rural supporters and his Trump-supporting supporters that they didn't want Democrats in mm-hmm. charge of the district. But the way that he said it might come back to haunt him a little bit in the general election. And this is another confusing bit about the turnout on this. Did people not turn out because they knew it was just to fill an unexpired term? When people come to the polls in November for the full term and O'Connor and Balderson face off again, will more Democrats come out than Republicans? That's not traditionally what happens, mm-hmm. but will that happen this year?
Hmm. Yeah, and I mean, it's a little context there. I mean, Balderson was talking to, I believe, a group of supporters in his home, Muskingum County, where he really needed to run the score up. And he did. I think
he said
it was 2-1.
He wanted 85%.
Yeah, well, he didn't get
didn't
need it either. But I mean, he actually did better in the primary in terms of percentage in Muskingum County than he did in the special election. But yeah, I mean, look, he shouldn't have phrased it quite that way, but I think he was trying to get the point across to his supporters. Hey, you guys need to show up and vote out here. Because they are definitely going to show up in Franklin County, and those folks aren't voting for me. I think that is that was the message. Like I said, maybe could have said it differently, but I don't think his supporters necessarily heard it differently than that. I don't think they took it as any knock on Pat Tiberi.
Worthington went something like 75% or higher for Danny O'Connor.
It was definitely well over 70%. Yeah, Worthington really went hard for Danny O'Connor, which was to me, a little surprising that it was that high.
Yeah, that high.
Well, as a Worthington resident, I can definitely say that they were on the ground for sure. You could not miss them. Mm-hmm. And the door knocking. And this was a real grassroots effort.
Very targeted.
Very targeted. They had the ability to do that because, as Jim said, there was only one race. And so they probably were looking at Worthington. They were looking at certain areas of Delaware County, including maybe Powell, that these were going to be the swing areas for them who might have supported a Republican in the past.
And Delaware did go a little bit more mm-hmm. that direction in toward the Democrat, right?
Right. It was still strongly Republican,
right.
But
more than it has in the past for Republicans in recent past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially in southern Delaware County. But the turnout in Delaware County was good overall, which really helped Balderson in the end. Helped him get over the top. I mean, look, when you're talking about 1,500 votes, you got to look everywhere as to why that happened. And it's part of the reason, I think, was for him was Delaware County's turnout. And again, back to this, the media outlets have not called the race yet.
Right.
In reality, it's probably single digit percentage that O'Connor has of actually turning the vote to his favor through the provisional and absentee ballots. I think it's maybe more like 50-50 that he gets it within a recount. But again, recounts tend to only change a handful of votes, maybe mm-hmm. Two dozen or three dozen votes across the district. And so I'm only saying this because I don't, people shouldn't get too excited if this does get to a recount and it's within 600 votes that all of a sudden Danny O'Connor is somehow going to utilize a recount to pick up 600 votes somehow. That traditionally is not the way it goes.
And I had someone say in comment on an article of mine that I posted something like, well, it seems so surprising that he was way out in front at the beginning of the evening, O'Connor was, and then suddenly, mysteriously, the Republican came back. And I was like, that is not surprising at all.
That happens
is not,
all the time.
It's not nefarious or any kind of a conspiracy. It's just the way they rolled in. And Delaware was particularly late. In coming in for Delaware, it was late. And so, that tipped, as Jim said, the high turnout there in a Republican county tipped it for Balderson.
We will continue our conversation about the 12th congressional district race. There's a little bit more to talk about. There's also ECOT and more. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides and our weekly reporter roundtable. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Still with us, Ohio Public Radio. I'm sorry, Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Jim Siegel. Thanks again, Jim, for joining us. And correspondent for the Associated Press, Julie Carr-Smythe. Thanks again, Julie.
Hi, Ann.
For listeners who are now we go into the general election, we go into the November election campaigning. How does the tenor of this race change given the, let's just assume that Roy Balderson maintains his lead, wins the race, this short-term race?
I would guess that both sides, both campaigns are going to talk about the tightness of this race. The Republicans are going to use it to try to say, listen, don't take this for granted. You got to get out. The Democrats are going to use it to say, we have a chance. Get out.
Get out the vote.
Right. And they're going to try to get the votes as many as they can. I mean, I don't think the ads and the door knocking and the postcards are going to cease anytime soon.
Independent voters, do we learn anything about how they were leaning?
Well, they're definitely leaning to O'Connor. They just didn't come out very strongly. I mean, it's a special election like this. Which tend to get the partisans out more.
Right.
Those who are registered DNR tend to vote more. And at least they did, particularly here in the middle of the summer. I mean, look, a lot of people didn't know what to expect This is a very rare thing to have a summer election for an open congressional seat. It's something Ohio, I don't know, has Ohio ever seen this before?
I don't think so.
Not that I'm aware of. But yes, the campaign is going to continue. I don't, you know, there's the Republicans are telling me that, look, if when the turnout gets higher and across the district, then Troy Balderson is expected to do better than he did. There's other arguments that if more independents start showing up and those independents are leaning against Trump, then perhaps, you know, Danny O'Connor can somehow pull this out. The problem is how much money will Danny O'Connor have to spend? He's not going to be the focus of the attention. But at the same time, neither is Troy Balderson. I mean,
they spent $5 million on that campaign. That's a hefty sum.
It is, and I don't think they're going to have the money to put into Troy Balderson in the fall, given that there are 60 plus races more competitive than this across the country for Congress. So, you know, he's going to have to rely on a lot of the campaign he's already done, footage of him with President Trump for this last time. And he's walking a very careful line here, and we don't know how it will sustain of trying to attract both the Trump Republican and the Kasich Republican. You know, he had both of those.
Ergo, the possible error in saying we don't want somebody from Franklin County representing us.
Yeah, maybe. But the Republican Leadership PAC, which spent over $3 million in this race, they put out a statement right after the presumed victory and basically said, look, we can't keep propping you guys up. You guys got to start raising, you know, and he wasn't just talking about Balderson, but clearly he was included in this. He said, look, you guys got to start raising your own money. You know, they got a lot of money, but they can't be dropping $3.5 million on each competitive
race.
60 races. That ain't going to happen. So they're looking for Balderson to do more. And, the other thing to note is that this may not be the most watched congressional race in the state, much less in the country now. Because
what else is up there?
Steve Chabot's seat down in Cincinnati is actually considered to be the better pickup chance in Ohio for Democrats than this seat. At least it was before this special election. The index is better. They've got a good candidate. The Democrats think they got a good candidate down there, and they think that if they're going to flip it, this will be the time to do it. It's sort of one of those blue wave districts that if there in fact is a blue wave that develops, that's a seat that could turn. The 12th could too, still. I don't want to say that won't happen, but I'm just saying that going into this, this was more seen as the seat that was more likely to turn Democratic if any are. And again, Ohio seats, very gerrymandered, making sure that Republicans hold a 12-4 majority in the delegation, and it's very hard to turn that at even by one seat.
And on the other side, because he did come so close so far, I mean, and could likely get a little closer, Danny O'Connor, do his fundraising prospects look brighter going into the general?
I would think so. And, of course, he didn't bring any particularly huge guns in the way that Balderson did. I mean, Balderson brought the president of the United States. There was no Obama, there was no Michelle Obama, there was no Joe Biden, and these are things that, you know, as a ticket now, as they head into the fall and they are trying to win the governor's race and other state races, we could see some big names, Elizabeth Warren, et cetera. Now, somebody like Elizabeth Warren, as tricky for Danny O'Connor as Donald Trump is for Balderson.
I was going to say, does Donald Trump necessarily a good thing at this stage?
Well, he certainly took credit on Twitter for winning the race for Balderson at the last minute, and it was very close. I mean, the last two polls were showing it within a point.
Right.
It ended within a point, so did Trump help or not? Mm-hmm. But in the case of Elizabeth Warren, who's sort of a darling of the left, Danny O'Connor has tried to walk this right down the middle, just as Balderson did. It's that kind of a district.
Moderate.
And people liked Teaberry for being moderate, reasonable. He left Congress, some would argue, because, you know, he's an establishment guy and he was in that crowd that decided to either retire or step away because of the climate there.
Yeah, I got to imagine Danny O'Connor would rather have someone like a Joe Biden come in rather than an Elizabeth Warren.
Is Biden doing a lot of
I don't
stumping
know.
Stumping at the Hustings
at this point, it's kind of early.
Okay.
So I don't know what his plans are at all. But again, like we said, there are, you know, there could be 60 House races in play. The key for O'Connor is going to be to try to get noticed by the national money in all of that. Mm-hmm. And he's going to have to cut through the clutter in Ohio. I mean, you're going to have a governor's race. You're going to have a U.S. Senate race, not to mention all the other statewides and the state legislative races that are going to be going on. There's going to be a lot of advertising, a lot of money being thrown around again this year. And as a congressional candidate, you have to try to cut through that. And, you know, you can be helped if there's coattails to ride.
In a way, I mean, it probably in some ways for Danny O'Connor, this has been a benefit to have this special election because it is very distinctive now. And when people go to the ballot, it isn't going to necessarily be lost in the shuffle. If you're making it to the ballot, you will have heard of him by now. So it seems to me it's more of an advantage for him than it is for Troy Balderson. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think both of them entered the race relative unknowns outside of their own particular areas. You know, Danny O'Connor's the Franklin County recorder. So people in Franklin County perhaps knew him. Balderson's the state senator from up in the Zanesville area. People up there knew him well. You know, they were both, even the Dispatch endorsed O'Connor and basically said they're both hardworking, middle of the road kind of guys. They endorsed O'Connor because they didn't like that Balderson supports Trump. And they said, we've editorialized too much against things Trump's doing. We can't. And, you know, will that be a trend across the country where the establishment media say, you know, well, we're not going to back candidates, even though we've traditionally backed Republicans who are with the president?
Well, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. And with me today is Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. I wanted to just do a rundown of these other races, you know, as we approach kind of that traditional kickoff point of the Labor Day weekend, a couple weeks away. U.S. Senate race, Democrat Sherrod Brown, also the incumbent, and is challenged by Republican U.S. Rep. Jim Renacci. I'm not hearing much about that at all.
It seems like there was some concern on the part of the Democrats at the start that Sherrod could be vulnerable to Renacci because Renacci was coming in with the backing of President Trump. Mm-hmm. And he comes in as pitching himself as an outsider, though he's been in Congress for about 7 years, but mm-hmm. as a business mind, mm-hmm. you know, a business style leader, which certainly worked for the president in this state. But as of right now, I haven't seen any recent polling mm-hmm. that has shown it particularly close.
No, the polls have it at double digits in the lead for Sherrod Brown. And I mean, look, you know, the Republicans lost their best candidate for this race when Josh Mandel dropped out. But, you know, Renacci's a fine he's an OK candidate. The problem is that Sherrod Brown is pretty popular in the state. And in a year like this, it's just going to be tough. It's going to be really tough to take him out, you know, with the person who's not your top choice in a year that seems to be favoring Democrats right now. So we'll see how that goes. But Sherrod Brown has plenty of money. He's got good messaging. He's actually on Donald Trump's side on some things with tariffs and that type of
NAFTA
stuff.
NAFTA and all that kind of
and
stuff.
NAFTA
right.
And NAFTA. Yeah.
You know, yeah, he is also holds the distinction of being the only statewide elected executive only statewide elected official in Ohio.
Who's a Democrat?
Sorry.
yeah, that last part's important.
I've been on vacation. So the question is, will he be joined by others come November? Governor Richard Cordray, Democrat, and Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine, the Republican, are talking policy, which is really interesting. It hasn't gotten too nasty yet. They're actually this reminds me of like the 90s or something, where they're actually proposing things like wellness legislation mm-hmm. and jobs creation legislation. It's interesting.
Sort of the anti-Trump campaign. You know, it's sort of the
two nice guys
just talking about policy and who's got the better ideas. And so far, You know, has it caught fire in either direction? No, not really. You know, maybe people are going to tune in on policy issues later toward the fall. I think there's some new ones even rolling out today.
Okay.
So, you know, and there isn't a big ticket item, I guess, perhaps with the exception of abortion, that, I mean, what one of the big ticket items, I should say, is off the table, which is that Cordray is a pro-Second Amendment, mm-hmm. as is DeWine.
And has a long record of that.
And if we're looking at the blue wave possibilities, you know, there was this youth movement that kind of came out of the Florida school shooting that looked like it was going to dominate the year. And it's neutralized, at least in terms of our governor's race.
Mm. Yeah. We have Attorney General, former U.S. Attorney Steve Dettelbach is the Democrat, State Auditor Dave Yost, the Republican. Anything cooking over there, Jim Siegel?
Well, with all these down-ticket races, what's interesting is in most of them, the Democrats have been outraising the Republicans. Now, that is something that you just have not seen much of at all right. in Ohio in the last few decades.
And yet it's absolutely necessary.
Well, if they want to win.
Republicans have dominated sure. financially for so long.
Right. Well, money follows power at yeah. the State House. Just ask all the legislative caucuses and how the Republicans just dwarf the Democrats in this, you know, there at the, you know, in the House and the Senate. But yeah, I mean, look, if there's going to be a year where these down ticket races, where the Democrat or even in governor's race, where the Democrats have a chance to kind of reclaim some of these offices that they haven't held for much of the last, you know, two decades or plus, this is it. And it's showing in the, you know, the fundraising numbers show that there is some enthusiasm behind these folks. Steve Dettelbach, in particular, has raised quite a bit of money. I think he's now up over $3 million in the bank, which puts him way ahead of all the other statewides. Now, Dave Yost has raised a considerable amount as well. Because he is the current state auditor, so he has that ability.
Well, he's been in office for quite a while now.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's well known and frankly he's well liked in a number of circles, all these races should be competitive and the Democrats should have at least a chance at all of these seats. Now, and I say that because that has not been the case in many many of these statewide elections we've seen over the years. I've been doing this since 98, and there's not too many
some
that I come.
Candidates
you can
here.
Come in a few months yeah. beforehand and say, "Boy, the Dems really have a shot here." Mm-hmm. It just hasn't been happening.
State for the Secretary of State seat, State Representative Kathleen Clyde's the Democrat. State Senator Frank LaRose is the Republican. Kathleen Clyde has been getting a lot of notice.
She's had this the Democratic group that's pushing secretaries of state candidates around the country coming in for her, reason being that this is the first round of elected officials who will redraw the maps for Congress. And we've just talked about a gerrymandered congressional district mm-hmm. in the 12th. They're
and the Secretary of State, of course, is on that panel.
Right. And so this is a big push that they're trying to say it looks like a sleepy down ticket race, but it's important nationally. So I did go to an event for her that I covered where the group came in to support her. Now, mm-hmm. Frank LaRose is also well known at the State House as pretty pragmatic. He's done a lot of bills to try to improve voting around the state.
What about the gender issue? She's the only woman. Obviously, Betty Sutton is the running mate with Rich Cordray and the Democratic ticket for governor. But other than that, Kathleen Clyde's the only woman running for statewide public office. Does that give her any kind of a boost, Jim Siegel?
In this year, yes. Yeah. I think because that's been a storyline that's out there, not only in Ohio, but nationally, that women are running for congressional seats, for legislative
unprecedented
seats.
Unprecedented rates.
At record rates. And yes, being the only woman on the ticket on either side, I think definitely will mean something. I think that's going to be an interesting race. She would definitely take a different view on election law and things like clearing voters from the rolls and things of that nature. Very different tact than we've seen from John Husted and others. Now, Frank LaRose is generally considered fairly moderate Republican, and so I think that will be a that'll be a good race to watch. And you asked me earlier about Dettelbach, and you know, one of the things that's really going on, and we'll talk about this soon, is the ECOD issue. Dettelbach is just hammering on that ECOD issue and saying that Yost did not act early enough. Yost, of course, saying that he acted when he could and has been pushing for reforms that have some of which have passed.
Right, and that is playing in the governor's race as well.
Yeah.
Mike DeWine, the sitting attorney general, is working on trying to go after ECOT now, and some of his legal arguments in that case, which ECOT lost last week, you know, are looking an awful lot like the arguments Democrats have been making for years. So, you know, the first thing that Joe Schiavone, who's the senator who had run for governor, came out and said was, you know, it looks like we've been right all along, you know, and that's not too far from the truth. I mean, in terms of what the legal, I guess, the lay of the land was at the end of that decision, where the Republican-dominated Supreme Court said, you know, ECOT does have to show some kind of proof that they're educating students. It can't just be how many have been enrolled in the school.
I want to talk about ECOT definitely when we get back. But before we do, I want to just run through Treasurer here. This is a race that I feel sleepy to me. Democrat Rob Richardson, Republican Robert Sprague, at this point, we're not hearing a lot from anybody, but we're not hearing a lot about.
Sprague's a state legislator, not well known. Richardson's not well known either. He is the only African American on either ticket right now, so that could play some role. But again, but treasurer's race, unless there's scandal, and not necessarily involving the candidates, but involving the office in itself, it's whenever with everything else going on, that office more than any other is hard to get people interested in because its duties just aren't that exciting. I mean, they invest money in it, and unless
as
they're
much
invest-
as they try to make it sound
well,
exciting.
I mean, and particularly since the current treasurer Josh Mandel is who knows where he is or what he's doing, and so he's not putting policies out there that the two of them can then say, I agree with Mandel or I disagree with Mandel or I would do it differently, because he's just not making any statements, nor has he really been one for that, with the exception of his online checkbook for 7 years. So he doesn't go out with big policy issues like that.
Let's be honest. The only reason people run for treasurer is so that one day they can run for something else.
It's a springboard.
It's nothing more than a springboard I think Ken Blackwell once said something about the only thing worse than running for treasurer is being it. But, you know, it's
Ken Blackwell, former Secretary of State, former gubernatorial candidate, Republican.
I mean, look, let's just be honest. I mean, we
from
you know,
Cincinnati. Yeah.
The Constitution says we need to elect a treasurer. We're going to.
By golly.
But, you know, this is
well,
not.
And speaking of former treasurers, though, an interesting little thing that happened with the Dettelbach campaign was that they apparently sold chances to meet Eric Holder when he was in town. A couple weeks ago, and Joe Dieters, who's a former state treasurer, now the prosecutor in Hamilton County.
He was a one-term treasurer, wasn't he?
He came out and kind of said that probably wasn't legal. I wouldn't have advised it. You know, all this is campaign season type issues that come up, and we don't know where they're going. But Republicans, I think, view Dettelbach as a pretty strong challenge, so they're definitely pressing some of his issues that are, you know, being raised right now. Among the other ones are the fact that he is possibly has a conflict in the pharmaceutical suit, which could be interesting. I mean, he says he doesn't. I interviewed Betty Montgomery, who says that he does. So, I mean, that race will get more interesting as the fall.
Betty Montgomery being a former attorney general for the state of Ohio. We will be right back. We'll talk about ECOT. We'll spend a few minutes on the auditor's race. And if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides and our weekly reporter roundtable. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Still with us is Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Jim Siegel and Associated Press correspondent Julie Carr Smythe. I just wanted to, we've been going through the statewide races up this November now that we're kind of heading into that. Heading into the home stretch, I guess. Maybe I'm just eager. But we do the auditor, Democrats, former state rep, or no, former U.S. rep, Zach Space, and state rep, Keith Faber, is the Republican.
Right. And he's the former Senate president,
which is his distinction, I guess. Not much at all. That's a real sleeper, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are they not raising money? Are they?
No, they're raising money. Not nearly as much as they are in the attorney general's race, which is
typical.
But,
isn't
but
it?
Again, Zach Space lately has been outraising Keith Faber a little bit, mm-hmm. And so it's again, yeah, that race has again. Zach Space has been hitting on the ECOT theme as well because Keith Faber has involvement in it as Senate president, and so expect that to continue to be an issue. Haven't heard the Republicans go after Zach Space very much yet. That'll be coming, I'm sure. But again, as you know, when we're talking about all these down ticket races, you know, you just some of them just haven't really caught fire yet, and that's not exactly surprising.
Yeah. Right. And so here's another pair of officials. You know, Keith Faber was president of the state Senate.
Big shot.
That's a real big shot at the state house. How much Ohioans, average, you know, Ohioans across the state are paying attention to his name mm-hmm. is probably very little. He's from western Ohio. And then you have Zach Space, who represented a congressional district south of Columbus for some years, one or two terms, I think. And so, you know, they're probably out just trying to get their names known,
yeah.
and talk to the local parties
that will just turn about who's turning out for the farther up the ticket races. If they're right. You know, traditional Democrats, they'll just vote Democrat or Republican. I mean, if they're traditional Republican,
Keith Faber will have a lot to talk about. I mean, as Senate President, you played a big role in a lot of the policy that went
but
through
that
the
also
state
makes
house.
Him a bigger target.
Absolutely, that's why. Yes, and that's what I was going to say.
I'm
that you
sorry.
Get that's okay. But yeah, it also everything you pass, you know, there's. You know, you can talk about, I mean, he can talk a lot about the jobs that have been created in Ohio and the tax cuts and things, and he can do it legitimately because as Senate President, he was intimately involved in crafting the tax cut plans and things of that nature. So he'll have plenty to say. We just haven't heard as much of it yet.
Right. And to get back to the 12th district and its potential impact, I mean, I think people in politics like nothing better than what appears to be a very close race. You know, what the ones we've just talked about, there's a lot of people that aren't well known. There's this kind of, as we said, very policy oriented kind of sleepy governor's race. There's a possibly very comfortable victory for Sherrod Brown. So how are they going to motivate people on the Democratic side? They don't have the gun issue in the governor's race. So perhaps it is Danny O'Connor who's their poster child for, you know, get out to vote. This is a very close year. There are all of these important issues nationally, and you're a piece of a bigger puzzle.
You know, and I'd be interested to see what Trump's approval numbers are in Ohio as we get closer to November. I mean, Trump won the state by, what, 8 or 9 points? And so I have not seen a poll where that has him anywhere close to that kind of an approval spread right now. If anything, he's pretty even in Ohio from what I've seen, if I recall. I mean, within 1 or 2 points being favorable to unfavorable. But so, you know, if in certain areas of the state, it may behoove you to push for an anti-Trump message if you're a Democrat. In other areas, that may not be nearly as helpful. They're going to have to. Democrats will maybe be relying on folks like Joe Schiavone, who unsuccessful candidate for governor, who has a lot of connections up in the Youngstown area that is very important for Democrats to reclaim that they kind of lost during the 2016 election to Trump.
I did want to talk about ECOT. The Ohio Supreme Court, as you mentioned, has ruled that the state is allowed, it's permitted to require online charter schools to show student login duration to verify enrollment and justify the state funding. I think the Dispatch called this a death blow to the electronic classroom of tomorrow, but it's already on the, you know, it's already the guillotine already
closed.
Fell. Yeah. But it's on the hook still for $80 million to pay back the state. It was ECOT's appeal to the Ohio Supreme Court. Is this its last stand, Jim Siegel?
Well, it's not the last stand. They do still have an appeal that's pending in trial court. The 10th District Court of Appeals recently allowed it to go forward, an appeal of the actual administrative process by which the decision was made to require them to repay the $80 million. Now, with this Supreme Court ruling, is some would argue that that is a long shot, but they have the right to pursue that. This is not about whether or not the state could legally use login duration time as a way to base funding. But this will kind of determine whether the Department of Education and the state board went through proper procedures in which to actually make the finding against them. Again, don't know how successful that will be, but as long as ECOT founder Bill Lager has money to pay attorneys and wants to continue to pursue that, that's what they're going to do.
And it's speaking of paying attorneys, you know, we also don't know the outcome of these criminal referrals that Auditor Dave Yost has made related to, I guess, alleged misconduct related to the way that they calculated enrollment and did some other things based on his last audit that perhaps drew down state money illegally. I mean, that's been the nexus that has not been made by prosecutors as yet. And there will be a lot of kicking and screaming by the Democrats headed into the fall that, you know, Republicans took too long trying to prove that and having findings that showed that. But I do think it has been a little bit of an onion that had to be peeled. At least as a reporter, I know that it has taken a while to figure out what was documentable, how to get records that would show what was happening. A whistleblower came forward that helped enlighten that somewhat, and mm-hmm. some of that was folded into the audit as well.
Two justices, Sharon Kennedy and Terrence O'Donnell, took the side of ECOT, and I'm wondering what were their arguments in that?
Sharon Kennedy wrote a very lengthy dissent and really laid out kind of why, you know, kind of from ECOT's perspective, why they believe that this was an illegal way, unconstitutional way to go forward. And, you know, it was interesting in that both the majority and the minority in this case pointed to the same section of law. It's a section that says a student is not allowed to get credit for more than 10 hours of schoolwork in a 24-hour period. Now, the majority said, well, that clearly shows that these schools were required to track how many hours these students were logged in. Therefore, it was okay for the state to do what it did. Mm-hmm. The minority with Justice Kennedy basically said, look, if the lawmakers wanted that part of the law to apply to funding, they would have just said so. But it didn't. It just talked about, you know, the amount of hours you're allowed to get credit for. So she said you shouldn't be extrapolating that this is somehow a funding-related issue. And so it's always been a very interesting legal argument, and could have judges all down the line here gone ECOT's way? I would say yes, they could have gone ECOT's way. However, the big problem for ECOT was they had a bad set of facts. At the end of the day, judges from the trial court to the Supreme Court could not get over the fact that ECOT was essentially arguing, we want to get full payment for students who don't do any work because that's what the law says we're allowed to do. And there was no judge or very few judges, justices who looked at that set of facts and said, yeah, that's good public policy. We're going to believe that was the intent.
That was the intent, yeah. Which is ultimately so. All right. So speaking of the politicians and what they intended back in the olden days when this legislation was passed, what are they talking about doing now to fix the problem?
Well, as I say, the DeWine administration is going forward with trying to I guess, claw back some of this money from what is left of the ECOD administration. There's still a board. There is an owner, Bill Lager, and going after his personal property is one of the ideas. He has mansions in various places or estates, whatever you want to call them, that, you know, maybe they can get some money that way. In the case of Yost's office, I know that he... as they were closing the school and they did, you know, sell the building and the assets, they seized some of the computer software, whatever, so that they're trying to prove that case. And then, you know, they would potentially be criminally liable if that ever goes anywhere. I mean, so many people up and down the chain have conflicts. The referral was made to Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien, and he had to recuse himself and hire an outside counsel because of an ECOT connection in his office. I think it was a former spouse of the ECOT principal was on his staff at one point. So, you know, I think criminal prosecution is one way to try to get the money back. I'm not sure.
Now, since the Supreme Court has ruled on this issue of whether or not you can count or how you should count, do lawmakers have to, or should they, or are they expected to introduce anything that would clarify the counting process for the purpose of state funding?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's certainly an argument to be made that, well, look, the Supreme Court ruled that what the Department of Education is doing is fine. Therefore, there's no reason to clarify the law. The law is clear enough. However, I do believe legislators are forming up a panel to take a close look at the way, irregardless of this decision, how Ohio is should be looking at funding e-schools and counting students for that purpose. I mean, there are some who say, like Dave Yost has argued, and others that, you know, we should be looking more at outputs, like how you know, course completions and testing and things, rather than how many hours you're actually logged in, as a way to determine whether you're actually engaged in school. And so they are going to be looking, I think, at potentially some changes. I don't know when those will. It could be in time, probably for the next budget, which will start up back in February. But I do think there's more work to be done in this area, and also this whole idea of that e-schools, because they're public schools, have to accept every student that comes in the door and says, "I want to join." There is some concern about that, because you need a special kind of student who's going to succeed at an e-school. It has to be someone self-motivated. It has to be someone with good support at home. And too many of the students who are attending e-schools right now, and ECOD in particular, are not that. And it was just doomed to failure. All those kids are just doomed to fail when you have to work from home and be self-motivated, and you don't have the motivation or the support at home to make it work.
I just want to let listeners know that we are going to devote an entire hour to ECOT, you know, the kind of the rise and fall of ECOT and online charter schools in the state of Ohio, and how the laws work and how they were intended to work and how they could get better, maybe, and all of this. So listen tomorrow at 10 a.m. We'll be talking about that. Just real quick, we have like 30 seconds left, but I understand while I was away that the Ohio Department of Commerce has said that medical marijuana will be available in Ohio by January. Yay, nay, thumbs up. I mean, do you agree? You quibble with that? What do you
think?
Well,
I mean,
Julie Carr-Smythe.
It's yet to be seen. There are still legal disputes out there, administrative hurdles to get by. Obviously, September 8th, they're wanting to offset anybody even talking about this on September 8th.
Yeah.
It could be.
Jim Siegel?
Well, they missed one deadline. We'll see if they hit the second one.
Okay, that's Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks again, Jim, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Julie Carr-Smythe, correspondent for the Associated Press. Thanks to you as well.
Happy to be here.
That's it today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.